From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier today when the first case was formally filed in a new housing section of Rochester City Court. As reported by our colleagues at City Newspaper, the new section will allow tenants to bring small claims against landlords and have judges hear their cases as soon as legally permissible. The purpose, broadly speaking, is to give Rochester tenants more leverage against landlords who aren't fixing up deteriorating properties, among other things. Now, the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester has been working on issues like this, along with a wave of other issues related to tenant rights. Some landlords have expressed concerns to us about unintended consequences, but this hour is a chance to explore what is happening with this new section of court and why, and whether our guests think it can work as intended. So hello to the guests in studio, including Mark Moyo, who's Program Director of the Housing Unit at the Legal Aid Society of Rochester.
Hi,
welcome
Evan.
Back. Thanks for being here.
Evan, thank you for having me.
You got it. Also with us is Ryan Acuff, who's a member of the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Hello to Pam Owens-Dade, member of the Citywide Tenant Union and president of the Manhattan Savannah Tenant Association. Pam, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And hello to Matthew Druin. Matt is managing partner of Oak Grove Development. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me as well.
Tell me what Oak Grove does.
We identify development opportunities and redevelopment opportunities, particularly with a focus on historic buildings. But we own all different types of real estate all over the city, multifamily, commercial, retail, you name it.
I think our listeners just want to know, are you a landlord?
I am a landlord, right, proudly, yes.
Very good. So let me just kind of go around the table and get a sense for what this is all about, why this has happened, because a lot, Ryan Acuff, has happened in the last year when it comes to tenant rights, these debates. This section of the court, tell me what the goal, you know, what we were trying to achieve with the creation of this.
Well, I think the goal is for every resident in the city to live in quality and good conditions. So the question is, how do you bring that about if so many people are living in really poor conditions? So there's many things that need to happen. But one of the many parts that we've been advocating for starting about 2 years ago when we were over at one of the Peter Hungerford properties on Dewey Avenue, the people didn't have heat. And that was the first time we sort of publicly called for this process for have a clear way for tenants to take their landlord to court in order to get repairs if they're not willing to do it. And that initiated this process. We started having meetings with Judge Doran, who's the supervising judge of the 7th Judicial District, and so initiated this whole process. So you know, we think tenants should have the right to take their landlord to court. Obviously, landlords take tenants to the court. It's about 8,000 plus cases filed every year, and tenant cases are, you know, almost none. So, trying to sort of even the balance of power, but ultimately, all as tools and tactics to live in good conditions.
Well, that first case filed today, just this morning, there's a big smile on Pam's face. It was you.
Yes. It was me.
What did you file over, Pam?
I filed for unhabitable conditions in my apartment. Horrible living conditions. No ventilation and several other code violations that have not been addressed.
Can I read from the actual?
Yes, you can read it.
So part of
read it.
The claim here, the brief description of the violations on the property. Mold, paint peeling, ventilation system, soiled carpets, no window insulation, poor air quality from asbestos particles.
Yes.
Okay. And how have the violations interfered with your tenancy? You write fatigue, migraines, and weight loss. How long has this been going on?
Oh, it's been going on for almost 18 months since this new asbestos abatement has begun over there. And I guess the demolition of the apartments and stuff, they're trying to remodel and reconstruct the apartments. And so they're starting to abate this asbestos that they're saying is all through the whole building, Manhattan and Savannah. And it's horrible with them, you know, doing that with all the chemicals being used. And it just seems so unsafe and so dangerous, you know. And I don't think they're just taking our safety first.
So what's your claim for? What do you want out of this now?
Well, that's been a long time coming. I just want what is fairly mine, you know what I'm saying? Because I feel I pay my rent every time, every month, on time. I'm never late paying my rent. If I was late, I'd be out. They'd have been through me out. That's why I'm still here. Pay your rent on time. It matters. Please pay your rent on time. It really matters. So that's why I'm still there, because they didn't give me what I paid for.
Do you want them to make repairs, or do you want them to compensate you for rent that you've been paying, given these
conditions?
At this
point, compensate. Compensate me, I'm saying, at this point, because it's been, you know, a long time. They haven't did anything. You know, they can do both, compensate and repair. Both.
Okay. When you have tried to press for these changes, what has the owner, the landlord, said and done?
They're remodeling, they're constructing, they're going to get around to my apartment. They're going to get around to my apartment. It's going to be in the next, it'll be summer next year, because it's taking time to get around to all the apartments they're doing, you know, I guess 12 at a time, 12 by 12, but they're going to get around to mine eventually.
You want to add to that, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a long back and forth with the tenants in Manhattan Square and Savannah, these two buildings downtown. You know, it's a huge, two huge complexes, about 376 units. And over that they're saying, well, the city says, well, you have to bring it up to health and safety code even while you're doing the full renovations. And, you know, so even in writing over and over, they say, well, we'll fix all the ventilation by the end of the month. It's always, we're on it. We'll be doing it. And then it drags on. So, there has to be a process, right? So if a tenant violates their agreement or their lease, there's a clear process for a landlord to come at them to either remove them or bring them back into compliance. And what we're missing now is a clear process of a landlord's out of compliance for the tenants to do that. So this special housing part, which is a part of the small claims process, is one part of leverage, which is getting money back for money that's already paid. I'm sure Mark's going to talk about it a lot as well, but there's other cases, I think maybe historic today is what I heard as well, mm-hmm. about to ordering repairs. So, and then, you know, the other process that we're really advocating for is emergency repair program through the city. So when the city issues a violation and they order repair and they fail to correct it, that the city comes in, makes the repair, and bills the landlord. So that process started through, you know, this original press conference 2 years ago at this Dewey Avenue apartment, where they created this process for no heat. And we've been engaging with the city through the City Rise process, which is facilitated by the New York State Attorney General. And the city, I think, is close to implementing this on a broader scale. And that's what we really want, because even the court, it's just a tool, right? But we don't even want to go to court, take a landlord to court, have it drag on for 6 months or a year and not get repairs. So ultimately, we want a clear process where people can get repairs.
Before I turn to the guests across the table, just to make sure I understand your complaint fully, Pam. Mm-hmm. You're not saying this is brand new. You're not saying this happened a month ago and now I want money and I want repairs done. It seems to me that the reason you're in court today is because you said this has been going on for a year and a half, and you keep telling me you're going to fix this, and you don't show. Yeah?
Yes, it's been over. Yes, but I've been living there for over 10 years, and 10 years my apartment has never been painted. I have the same paint. They never changed my carpet. Everything is still the same. They have never did any painting in my apartment.
So this is not new.
Nothing
new.
Do
you have more sympathy for landlords who will say, you know, look, it's complex. I've got a lot of units. I don't want to make false promises. I'm going to try to get there. You know, some landlords will say, give us a little bit of time. We will get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not all trying to make things very difficult for you. Do you appreciate that?
Yes, I appreciate
but
that.
But you just don't feel like you're in one of those properties.
I appreciate working with landlords. And over the past, I've worked with a lot of landlords. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm about to be 65 on Friday. So I've been through a lot in Rochester with the landlords and living in apartments and stuff. But this is by far one of the worst.
You're going to be 65?
I'm going to be 65. January 24th.
Our listeners can't tell, but
the 24th
you know
January.
You don't look it.
Thank you, God. God is good.
Before I get Mark Moyo's assessment here, because you know, Mark has been working on these kind of issues for years, let me get managing partner of Oak Grove, that's Matt Druin. You know, as a landlord yourself, how do you feel about the creation of this section of city court? Is it appropriate?
A little too late.
A little too late?
Yeah, yeah. The city has been, I mean, I really think the creation of this court is through a public relations response with the city of Rochester. When you condone, you encourage. And, you know, I drive through the city every single day. I'm a city resident myself, and it breaks my heart every time going through city Rochester City neighborhoods and seeing code violations in broad daylight, conditions with tenants that have gone on for decades that have been overlooked and a blind eye turn. And the city of Rochester has had the tools at their disposal to correct these issues. So I'm in support of this housing court. However, I think that a creation of a separate court confuses the whole process. I think that we need to develop a model similar to Buffalo, where we have a housing court that it presides over both of those issues, evictions due to non-payment as well as that. It's not like reinventing the wheel. We look to Buffalo for leadership on that and replicate what they're doing.
All right, Mark Moyo, who is the program director of the housing unit at the Legal Aid Society of Rochester. First of all, is this a long time coming? Do you agree that this section is the right move here?
I think it's a great step forward. My preference would be for what Matt just outlined, where one judge has the expertise, the commitment, and the responsibility for all of these matters, whether it's the city of Rochester bringing cases against landlords for severe housing code violations, whether it's tenants bringing those same types of actions, or if it's simple eviction cases, whether it's holdover proceedings or non-payment proceedings, which go on every day in Rochester City Court. Having one judge be responsible for all those, I think, makes the most sense. And in terms of consistency, efficiency, and I would say expertise.
Matt's saying this looks like a PR move by the city. Is that a fair description? You think this is sort of a saving face move?
It's a little convenient in terms of the time, isn't it? I mean, in the face of what of Ron Zohr, Peter Hungerford, these people don't operate in a vacuum, okay? We have code enforcement officers out there. Most of us that are responsible landlords have relationships with those code enforcement officers. We have updated CFOs. But me as a real estate broker as well, a realtor, I go through inner city neighborhoods that are lower income neighborhoods and see houses that have current CFOs, like the ones that are for sale. And I'm like, how the hell does this house have a CFO? And I understand the philosophy behind the city to quote unquote turn a blind eye to it. They did not want to turn the screws to landlords and then risk displacing residents by making it harder for those slumlords. It's time to take responsibility.
But Matt, I mean, maybe the city would say, look, everything you're describing, then why are you not giving a thumbs up to this section of this isn't a face saving move. This is doing the right thing.
Yeah, I just said too late. It is too late. Too little, too late.
Okay, well that's blunt. Go ahead, Mark.
As someone who's, I don't want to say I've been in every single meeting, but Ryan and I's, both of our actions kind of started at the same time. Mine came out of working at the Legal Aid Society and also being a county legislator, and events that were going on with Ryan and the tenants union kind of evolved at the same time. I don't see it as exactly as Matt does in terms of a reaction by the city of Rochester. Even though it's called city court, it's small claims court. It's run by the court system. It is essentially a state court. The city of Rochester doesn't fund it and doesn't get at least an official say in what happens in city court as much as the name might say otherwise. It's a state court and that just deals with the city of Rochester. So I want to be clear about that. It's been a collective effort of a lot of people in the city, people in the court system, and then people in the not-for-profit sector, the Legal Aid Society, Legal Assistance of Western New York, Volunteer Legal Services Project, all working together to try and form something that the court thinks is viable and legal and that also addresses this problem. So as someone who's been in the room for a lot of these discussions, I just wanted to be clear about what was going on.
Sure. Ryan and Pam, do you agree with Matt's assessment that it's sort of too little too late and that they've had a chance to do a lot more over the years and this is sort of face saving? What do you think, Ryan?
Well, any improvement is for the present and the future. I mean, should improvements have been made a long time ago? Of course, right? So, but we can't go backwards. We can only go forward. So we need to continue building off these reforms and we need, you know, the basic tenant protections, right? The good cause eviction protections. If someone can't be evicted without a cause, or nobody's going to raise an issue. This is what we face over and over, is that the terror and the fear people have to raise issues. Like in Pam's case, since she's in a regulated building, she's got good cause eviction protected. So initially, when her landlord tried to evict her for raising the issues about the, it wouldn't work, right? So they tried to evict her, but it wasn't legal. So the eviction got overturned, right? But we need those basic protections, and we need a program that's actually going to make the repairs. Like Matt's talking about, this has been going on for over and over. There are places that have been horrible for many, many years. Mm-hmm. But we need an actual process that'll have a solution for, they come in for the really bad actors. They come in, they make the repairs, and there's a process for tenants to have a voice in the process.
Let me also appeal to listeners who may be landlords themselves, and anyone who may have a different view of this, because some landlords warned us before, and we'll get there. I'll ask our guests if they think there are any unintended consequences coming down from this. But you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program. It's connections@WXXI.org. And I want to kind of take the temperature of the panel on one thing here. Because anytime we talk housing, I hear from landlords who feel like they get caricatured. So I'm someone who I live in Rochester. I rent. I live in Shalott. I've got a great landlord. I feel very, very fortunate. Incredibly responsive guy. Never had an issue. I understand the frustrations of people who feel like, I've been waiting months for stuff just for a response. Just quick estimate in your mind. Mark, do we know how many your landlords there are in the city of Rochester?
How many landlords there are?
Do you have any idea?
Oh, I don't have that with me.
Okay.
It'd be available. Well, and it's also hard to know with incorporation and LLCs and things like that.
Mark's going to hate this question, so I'll ask him last. But Matt, of all the landlords in Rochester, what percentage do you think are doing the right thing, are the good ones? What percentage are the good ones? And I don't like to usually simplify it this way, but I want to see where your mind is on what the landscape looks like.
The landlords that own property in middle to higher income areas are very responsible landlords. The ones that own property in lower income areas, there are some of them that are doing the right thing. And those are the people that, with the new laws, are punishing these landlords that are actually fighting the good fight in terms of providing really high quality affordable housing in the lower income neighborhoods in the city. It's kind of a mixed question with
fair.
Mixed answers. So, and that's how, and you know, and that's kind of how, you know, things are, is that lower income people get, you know, typically don't have as much, don't get as high quality services. So,
okay, Pam, what do you think?
I feel like as long as the landlords do what is expected and take care of the property, and working with the tenants hand in hand, it will work out good. It should work out.
Do you think most landlords are doing the right thing?
I give it 80% of them.
Are doing the right thing?
I think so.
Okay.
I've met some great landlords. Yeah. I have really met some great landlords.
Yeah, and Matt's just saying that the lower income, that's where you get more hit and miss.
Yes.
50-50 at the lower end?
Mm.
Is it worse than that?
I don't know. Mm. I think if you can, you'll know a man by their fruits. So drive through the neighborhood and you can, maybe 50-50. And you can see the problems right from the outside of the house. You don't have to go inside and investigate or anything like that.
Okay.
So,
Ryan Acuff, what do you think?
I think it's hard to put a number on it. I mean, I think probably maybe half of people don't think about their landlord because it's just not something that, you know, that there's not a major issue or
that's
conflict.
Probably a good thing, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So it's good if that people aren't thinking about that situation.
Yeah.
But I want to be clear that it's not just about, well, you know, who's a good landlord, who's a bad landlord, but what do we want to see as a society? So what are the systemic changes? What are the priorities that we want to see? Right, which it's not just about who's a good or bad landlord. Do we want to see everybody have a house? Right? Do we want to see everybody have a quality place to live? I think that's the way I would want to see it. And what are the policies and practices that would bring that about? Because it's really not personal, right? So if we want to make a change, right, it's not personal against Peter Hungerford or Rodzor. Yeah, people that have been through that, it's personal for them.
But
overall, it's, well, what's the society we want to live in, and how do we prioritize what we want to see? So, and I think, you know, what happens a lot is whenever we talk about making any progressive change or tenant protections or new programs, there's always a fear of, well, we're going to drive away investment. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest thing. And we hear that sometimes in the background from the city sometimes. We don't want to drive away investors. I think we need to make a big distinction between what's investment and what's extraction. Mm. Because a lot of people are coming in and they're extracting wealth, right? And then they'll say, well, we're bringing all these great things. We're bringing, but the wealth is coming up and into a few pockets. Mm. And what we want to do is spread it out and build community wealth through cooperative housing, you know, and permanently affordable cooperative housing, through community land trusts, where the wealth that's generated is shared and spread out, and it's not just going into a few pockets. So I think that's this idea of, well, any investment is good, any development is good, right? No, well, we need to actually say what's the quality over quantity, what's really spreading the wealth and the good conditions and jobs throughout the neighborhood, and what's extraction coming into a couple pockets.
Okay, and did I assume correctly, Mark? You wouldn't like that question?
No, I'm fine with that question. I mean, I would just state that my father's a landlord. His brother, my uncle, is a landlord, going back a couple of generations. So that I don't have some sort of hatred or anything like that.
No, but you think most do good work?
And all I want to say is my experience beyond that, dealing with landlords, is mainly set in Rochester City Court, the landlord-tenant part. So that would be like asking an emergency physician if they think that
most people
are healthy. Yeah, right. So it's a it's a very difficult question for
Fair
me
enough.
To answer. I'm not going to answer it. What I want to say is what usually comes out to me, and this is a generalization, is that people who have face-to-face relationships with their landlord, someone who's present in the community or is here a lot of the time, I don't want to control where people live, but have hands-on experience with another person, their relationships are usually good. When you separate it by a number of either an incorporation and then a property management service that is sometimes switched around numerous times within 1 year, things get put by the wayside. Mm-hmm. Problems are not fixed. Communication breaks down, and that's where things start to go wrong. And pretty quickly in a city like Rochester, with an old housing stock, with the weather that we have, a house can fall apart very fast.
Matt Druin wants to jump on that. Go ahead.
So on Monday, I was on a bus to Albany with about 30 or 40 landlords and tenants with our coalition under one roof. There's a reason why 40 Rochesterians got in a bus that are housing providers and tenants to go to Albany. There's people that took time off from work. There's people that didn't get paid to go do that. And it is because we have our local housing providers that are already feeling feeling these laws, making it harder for them to run their business. And they're frankly getting, they're capitulating. And I think that just to, like what Mark said, that these laws, you know, I do think that they have a link to disinvestment, and disinvestment leads to disconnection. So you are going to see over the next couple of years, just by death by a thousand paper cuts, you're going to see a lot of local landlords dumping their properties. They're going to go to people from California, people from New York City that are not so connected to their communities. That's what I see happening, and that's why we're asking for repeals. Are not repeals, but amendments to the laws to make it more balanced.
Okay, we'll get to a little bit more specific in a moment. Go ahead.
Well, Matt. I just wanted to be so. I think what Matt is talking about, there are a number of laws passed, or there was a big law amendment passed in June of 2019, a follow-up very small amendment that was passed in November, and I believe that's what Matt is talking about. Not the court that was created,
right?
Because there was no law that created that court. It was a local initiative. So if we want to have a conversation about the changes to the real property law and the other laws affecting tenancy, we can absolutely do that. But I just wanted to separate those two things.
Fair enough. So let's get back to that in a moment. But let me get some feedback from listeners, including Bob in Rochester, who is a tenant who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes. I don't know if anybody knows about what they're doing on the tenant side. I get two letters posted to my door saying to pay rent. I get a security guard dropping off a notice at night that I have to answer the door for, hand to me in person. I get a letter in the mailbox, and I get a registered letter, and my rent's really not late until the 10th, and I get my Social Security check on the 3rd. And, you know, so I don't, you know, and it's, to me, it's not even, you know, I know my rent's paid, so I don't worry about it. It's the amount of money that's being wasted with all the time and effort that these people have to go through. And all that I hear from people, and it's not just in this situation, there's other situations I get put through. It's not me, it's them. You know, it's somebody else making me do it.
All right, so you know, all right, Mark, you want to handle that question?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Bob. Bob is referring to a number of parts of what was amended in the law in June of 2019 requiring certain types of notices. One thing is called a 14-day notice. So if you haven't paid your rent, a landlord can issue a 14-day notice. You have 14 days to pay the money that is on that piece of paper. If that's not paid, then a court case can be started. It's a prerequisite to starting a court case. He's also referencing the requirement that if rent is not paid by the 5th, then the 5th of each month, then a receipt of non-receipt is meant to be sent to a tenant by certified mail. And I don't know the last piece that he's talking about, but those are the two that I'm aware of. The receipt of non-receipt is a complex issue that some people are still debating, but it's really meant to, in cases where there's a dispute about how much rent has been paid, is to have a receipt for every month, whether rent was paid or not. So if rent was paid, there would be a receipt, as there always has been. If rent was not paid, then and there was a dispute about it, then the landlord would have to produce the receipt of non-receipt to show that every month is accounted for one way or another, paid or unpaid. And that would create a better trial record than what we have had before, which said, I don't give receipts when I don't receive rent. In the absence, there is an absence, which was not helpful in court to try and prove or disprove things.
Right. Anybody want to add to what they heard from Bob there? Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I have been hearing tenants reach out feeling that they're being harassed under the new law. It's just the notice requirements and also the service requirements that are under the new law that was passed. And that's what we're actually advocating for in Albany, is to simplify that notification process so that, I forgot which judge it was, but you may be able to give light on this, Mark, but throughout 14 cases last week, because the landlord had service on three times, but on two different days, and the judge required them to be on three different days at three different times. So that's probably why this tenant got a service in the middle of the night while he was sleeping. So that's one, it's duplicitous in a lot of the things that have been passed.
Okay. Bob, thank you. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the launch of the new housing section of Rochester City Court, designed to allow tenants to have a little bit more equal footing to push back and challenge landlords who have not been making repairs or doing the things that they're supposed to be doing. And our guests are talking about the impact of that court. Let's stay with your phone calls. This is Calvin in Rochester next. Go ahead, Calvin.
Hey, Evan, how are you? So I'm going to try to condense all that I have to say, but I want to sort of a question and a comment. So the comment first, piggybacking on what Ryan Acuff said a bit ago about focusing on the systemic in this conversation. So one of the things that has been, sort of brought up in the conversation thus far is that these are conversations in terms of tenants' rights that have been being had in Rochester for many decades, several years with landlords. There's been some very high profile cases, Dewey Avenue, Thurston Avenue, South Wedge, et cetera, where landlords have exploited predominantly black and brown tenants who are low income, and they have not been able to, the city in some cases has turned a blind eye. And I think that it was Matt who said that the city of Rochester is complicit in not holding slumlords accountable. So I think that when we're stuck in the individual, we're missing the point that this is one step in the direction of a systems change that has been long overdue in the city of Rochester, in terms of landlords who have been allowed to chronically have properties and exploit tenants who are traditionally lower income and traditionally who are not white. Right. So I think Matt said something that typically in the area, just sort of looking at statistics, that landlords who rent upper income, et cetera, they typically do really well. So the question then that I'm asking is, like, why has the city allowed it to get to this where we may feel like the current laws are overreaching, too broad? And I also want to say, where were the landlords? Where were the landlords like Matt Druin and like others, perhaps, who have worked with low-income tenants, who have done a really good job. Where were they for the years when there have been protests and rallies, and people like Mary Lupien and Ryan Acuff have been rallying behind many people that I know and love in the community? Why are they just now entering the conversation as landlords who are trying to do well? Where were they for the last 10 years where we've been having these conversations that have impacted predominantly lower income and black people? And now that it's now maybe impacting them on an individual level, they're all of a sudden wanting to enter into the conversation. So that's what I want to hear some responses to. Thank you.
All right, Kelvin, thank you. I'll let Matt Druin start.
So yeah, I do agree that there is a systemic thing going on here. You know, in response, I think that the landlord groups for a long time have been talking about putting together a coalition with landlords and also tenants. It's just a thing as if a can that's been kicked down the road many, many times, because we've just been focused on doing our job, which is hard enough in terms of delivering quality housing to our tenants. So this was sort of a kick in the teeth, the passage of this law, and was the one thing that motivated us to galvanize. Now, I'm not going to say that it was, you know, it's like, oh, I'm happy this law was passed, but it did create that action. And then a response to the systemic level things here, you know, we are the ones that are resourceful and create housing and make it a sustainable business model. Why have we not been consulted by the city, by nonprofit groups, to get our ideas on what it would take to correct a lot of the housing issues, a lot of the poverty issues that are attributed to housing in this city? We have not gotten asked once. So that's my frustration with the whole thing. So,
okay. Ryan, what do you make of what you heard there?
Oh, many things. Well, for one, I mean, before this law was passed on June 14th, New York was ranked 39th in the country in tenant protections, tied with Alabama and Texas. So the idea that we improve tenant protections for the first time in 45 years, and it's a kick in the teeth to landlords, it's very sad that that's taken as a kick in the teeth, where the balance of power is still in favor of landlords. So it was reforms, but it's still modest compared to what we need. We're nowhere close to housing as a human right. We do work with landlords that are interested in providing quality housing. Pam and I just came from a meeting where, you know, a landlord is trying to take over some of these problem buildings. And we did a negotiation with the landlord and the tenants. We talked with them about, you know, how are the programs working. So we talked with the landlord about the affordable housing programs. We talked with the state. So there are dialogues about that. I know in the past where we've talked with you, Matt, about programs. You said, well, we do workforce housing. We don't provide housing for these folks or that folks, that everything. So I guess the discussions we have had, there doesn't seem to be common ground. So because we believe that there should be opportunities for all tenants to purchase. We've actually talked to you about that, about cooperative housing. So we want to partner with people that are following the grassroots of the community. If people don't want to do it, you know, we're just going to keep going, right? Because it's the issue is so dire, the level of poor conditions so many people live in on. And like Calvin said, these issues are racialized, right? People that are living in really bad conditions, majority of them are people of color, right? The people that are being evicted the most, evictions are racialized, right? The affordability problem is racialized. And so the issues are so urgent. We'll work with anybody who wants to work with tenants to make lives better. So we work with the landlords who want to do it, and the ones who don't, that's their choice.
Anything you want to add there, Matt?
The conversation that Ryan may have been referring to was one maybe 20-minute meeting at a McDonald's after my Monroe Avenue project. I did work with Mary Lupien to lessen the blow of my transformation of that project. We were able to keep some of the tenants through their protests. It did did humanize the situation there. So I do thank them for actually doing that. But there has been no further conversation from there, and I invite further conversation with Ryan, his group, and other concerned groups to see how we can work together.
Is there going to be an invitation then?
It sounds like there was one. I mean, we're willing to work with anybody who wants to make lives better for tenants.
Right. Pam, you want to add something there?
Yes, I want to add something. Well, I really hate what has happened in Rochester. You know, I was raised in Cornhill, on Edinburgh Street. My dad owned property down there. My dad was a landlord. He had two houses in Cornhill until the gentrification came along and bought up all the property. We were low income, so he sold the house to move to better 1904 for us, for his children. And I think what for these landlords, what they've done, it made it all about money, money, money. And they're buying up all this property, these out-of-town landlords, and not living in Rochester and just treating us any kind of way. I feel that landlords need to live in Rochester if they own property in Rochester. Well, I wish, would hope that would be, but I know it's not going to be. But that would be, if it was my way, that would, I would have it. You have to live right here and be present.
All right, so I think everybody agrees that you got a better chance to have a better relationship with your landlord if you can see him in person.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. We'll take more of your phone calls, and we are going to hit briefly people like Matt Druin as a landlord concerned that we will see more out-of-town landlords based on recent policy, not necessarily this housing court section. Matt will explain why he feels that way, and we'll let our guests respond as well. We'll take more of your feedback as well as we talk about changes, some of the changes when it comes to housing policy, this housing court section in the city of Rochester. In studio, we have Matt Druin, managing partner of Oak Grove Development. Ryan Acuff is a member of the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester, as is Pam Owens-Dade. She's also president of the Manhattan Savannah Tenant Association, and she filed the first case in the new section, the new housing section of Rochester City Court. And Mark Moyo is a program director of the housing unit at the Legal Aid Society of Rochester. More of your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. What would you do if the next time you went to get a bottle of olive oil or a bottle of French wine and the price had doubled? Would you still buy it? A lot of people would say no. The proposed Trump tariffs on European Union goods and wine could go into effect, a 100% tariff. We explore the possible impact. In our second hour, the opening of the Dialogue on Disability 2020. Talk with you Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back here. I hustled back in because it was the shortest break in radio. I was Pam and I were up out of our chairs. Glad to have you with us on this Friday afternoon. So before we jump back to your phone calls, if you're on the phone, we're going to get all of you. Real briefly, Matt Druin, you understand Pam's frustration with this growing number of tenants who can't even see a landlord in person, right? That's a fair concern. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's gotten harder and harder to what I see is that the disconnection happens is that a in-town landlord that's doing the right thing, responsible, gets fed up. It's not an easy business. We don't get phone calls from tenants saying, "Hey, Mr. Landlord, you're doing a good job." Mm-hmm. So we get a butt kicking pretty much every day based upon what we do, from managing maintenance, from managing problem tenants, because there are problem tenants out there. I think you probably can agree with that. So these landlords throw their hands up. They sell it to an out-of-town investor, which a third-party management company takes it over, who has no problem complying with the new, with the new notice requirements, because if they're managing 2,000 units, then it's just a lot easier for them. For me, I actually have to go to the post office, get a mail certified. Let me
jump in. Be specific, because what he's talking about is not the new housing court section, as Mark pointed out. It's part of the policy that passed last year. Specifically, what? What do you think is going to drive local landlords to sell and bring in more outside investors?
Oh, geez.
What stands out on that list that you don't like?
The thing that annoys me the most is, because I own property in higher income neighborhoods, is that is the double security deposit. We can't collect any more than 1 month's rent security deposit.
At the outset, to protect yourself.
At the outset, to protect ourselves. Because usually when we have to go through an eviction process, It gets drawn out. Some people say 30 days. It's more like 60 days. So that gives a buffer in the wake of that. So in the past, when we have an application that doesn't get approved, but we actually take a deep dive into the credit history. We see they have some collections and stuff like that we can decide to take the risk if we offer that tenant a double security deposit. And oftentimes they're more than happy to do that, to live, to move out of Orange Street, to move out of some of these other areas of the city where they don't want to live. And now we can't do that. And usually the tenant, you know, if they have perfect on-time payments for the whole year, we haven't even in writing at the onset that you can get that other half your security deposit returned to you because you have a seasoning in your lease with on-time payments. So that's the one thing that's annoying to me. And then there's also just the notice requirements for late payers. We're seeing delinquency rates go up from 2% to 7% from one of the larger housing providers in Syracuse just in the wake of these new laws. There's nothing else that's changed except these new laws. So why are delinquency rates coming up? It's because tenants then, you know, we all juggle bills, right? So if it's easier to not pay your rent because you can pay your car payment and your cell phone payment and everything else you have to juggle, this gets tenants further behind and leads to evictions due to non-payment eventually. And that's those are the two things that kind of stick out to me. So.
Okay. So Ryan and Pam, he's saying that these new policies are going to drive more of the local ownership out. What do you think?
I think it's the exact opposite. I think, just to give an example, you know, there was a New Jersey landlord, Stein Capital, who was talking about buying up a huge portfolio in Rochester, right? The reason was they say, well, in New Jersey, we've got strong tenant protections, and in Rochester, it's lower property values, and it's a total, like we talked about, the low level of tenant protections. So people prey on places like this. This is why we have so many out-of-town landlords, from out-of-continent landlords, because they know that it's been the wild, wild west for so long. So the people that are able to run a responsible business, what we're talking about, people you can see and know, those are the ones that are going to be committed to providing quality housing, and there's going to be more of them that are going to rise to the top. Where the people that, you know, the brokers who come and buy in cash and all this crazy stuff that happens from all over the country, right? They're not going to want to go to places with stronger tenant protections. It doesn't make sense as an investment if you're from out of town to go places where it's stronger. So what we had before was a race to the bottom, just like we have in labor law. Well, people, if labor restrictions are strong in one country and they're weak in another, people will go to China or some other place where there's less labor protection. Well, the same happens with landlords. They'll go to the place where there's the least amount of tenant protections. And now Rochester is increasingly not going to be that place. And people from out of town are going to increasingly not buy up in Rochester.
All right. So, Mark Moyo, which argument makes more sense to you?
I'm not going to weigh in on the policy issues. I'm sitting here as an attorney. What I want to say is, under the old laws,
I'm making you a judge.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan. Under the old laws, and this didn't happen all the time, but I mean, I witnessed it myself. Someone could not pay rent on the first of a month and be actually out of the house by the 17th of that month. That's no longer possible. You know, the case won't even be filed until the 15th or the 19th of the month that's in question. So what it does give some people some elasticity, but the rigidity from before was kind of ruinous to some people, in that either, you know, their funds weren't coming through, or whatever assistance they were applying for wasn't coming through in that short period of time. Those timelines were extremely short. We can sit here and argue about what a proper timeline is, but really nothing is handed down from on high. Things have to be developed in the real world. So those were the best parts of the new law from my point of view, in that people are giving a little bit more time before a case can be filed, because nobody wants to go to court. That doesn't really help anybody. It costs the landlords money that they're not going to recover. It makes people miss work, and it causes people anxiety, and getting evicted is no fun and no good for people's lives. So to be able to make that payment in a, say, 30-day period and catch yourself up, get yourself on a payment plan that's outside of court is great. And I think that's what that is hopefully encouraging. We're going to have to see what comes out. It's only been 6 months. But I want to wait and see. I do think that there, to take your initial question, I think there is going to be some consolidation in terms of landlords, whether it comes from out of town or in town, I don't really know, and I'm watching out for that. But consolidation, by that I mean, I don't know if people are going to be able to hold a portfolio of two or three units at this point, given the risks that are inherent in what I just outlined, timeline-wise. So maybe slightly larger landlords are going to be owning more and hopefully can be responsive and responsible with that greater amount of whatever you want to call it, capital or investment or responsibility. So that's where I see things going, but I'm going to wait and see what ends up happening in our city.
Okay. That's something we'll revisit in June you know, we'll mark a year. We'll see where we are. Because I know there's been a lot of debate about what the impacts are going to be. Let's focus the remaining part of this program on this new court section, and let me get Ellen on the phone next. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hey, guys. This is Ellen Smith from Keeping Our Promise. And I resettle Afghans and Iraqis who work for the military. I have to deal with 25 to 30 landlords a year in our program. What I find frustrating, and I'd like to know what the solution is when there are housing codes and we get them fixed, if we complain to the city, then their DSS is cut off, but then they get a letter, their DSS for rent, but then they get a letter that says you're still technically responsible for the rent and just bring this to landlord court. And that just seems crazy. And then the other issue I've run into is that I'm searching on Craigslist for housing, and I've now learned to ask if they have an occupancy permit. But the fact is there's tons of landlords who rent, and it turns out that they don't have occupancy permits. And I think, I don't know if that's illegal, but it should be illegal. And I'd just like you to address this issue of a tenant losing that portion of rent, but yet they're still legally responsible for the rent when there's code violations.
Ellen, thank you. Can someone go ahead, Mark?
Right in my exact expertise area. So, what is what Ellen just outlined? If the Department of Human Services, Monroe County DSS, Welfare—those are the names that people generally use for that. The official name is Monroe County DHS. If they stop paying your rent, and this is not me giving legal advice, I'm outlining the law, then you should not be evicted. So the letter will say that you should consult an attorney and that you may be held responsible. I don't know if it says the word may, but may be held responsible for the rest of your rent. They're trying to not give improper advice in that letter, is my understanding. And if someone has that letter and it's ongoing, they should definitely bring that to court if they are brought to court, because it's a very strong defense. I'm not going to say it's worked in 100% of the cases, but it should. It's a very strong defense if you've been cut off from the Department of Human Services. Her second point of view, or her second question or point, regarding certificates of occupancy issued by the city of Rochester, that is just coming up. That was the second law that I pointed out, was signed on November 6th. And I have to be honest, we're still developing that law. We're still trying to find cases in city court that where we can find the outlines of that law and what it means. So I do not want to give people advice to, number one, stop paying their rent, or to say it's going to be a 100% defense in a case that they may have, because it's still being developed, and I don't want to give faulty advice that causes people problems. But the language of the law seems to say that if there's no certificate of occupancy and your property has three or more units, that you might not be responsible for paying your rent. But I want to caveat that with saying that is not legal advice right now.
All right, so as we get ready to wrap here, let's get our arms around this new section of court. And Pam Owens Dade, yours is the first case in this court. We're going to see a lot more here. How will you know yourself if this section of court is working the way it's supposed to?
I'll find out on February.
You're saying if I win.
When I go before the judge. I don't believe nothing until I see it. They make a lot of promises. We're going to see.
What does it mean to you to be able to have this opportunity to have this section? I mean, are you an optimist that this is the right thing to do? What do you think?
Yes, I'm very excited about this. It's been a long time coming, and I'm very, very excited about this. But I also think that the landlords should be given a time period to repair some of these things that need to be fixed, you know, because some things need to be done quicker than others.
All right. So let me ask Ryan Acuff, for you, how will you know if this is working the way it's intended?
Well, if people are living in better conditions. I mean, I agree nothing should be a press release, nothing should be a public relations. It should be about making people's lives better. And I think this is one thing that we need, in addition to a process where tenants can order repairs and the city can make sure the repairs are being done if these orders to repair are violated. So I think all of these things together and the basic tenant protections where people are willing to speak up and organize, these are the things that are going to make people's lives better.
Okay. Matt Druin, you said earlier this hour that this is late in coming and maybe not enough. You'd like to see it in a different sort of a form. What do you want to see the city do with this?
Form a housing court like they have in Buffalo to preside over both of those issues. That's basically it.
That's it.
Oh, and beyond the housing court thing?
Well, no, I mean...
Because I have a lot to talk about.
we're going to come back on a different day and keep focusing on this. On the court, though, if they did what Buffalo has done, why would that be a better solution than what they have now?
Because what I've seen in the past year is that there were some properties that I looked over in South Carolina, for instance. They had a separated court on the two. Now, if a tenant, let's say, has a heat issue and stops paying rent, so they file in this court and they get seen in 22 days, I think it is.
Yeah, within 22.
Landlord files for eviction based upon that non-payment. That is very confusing to me because there's going to be two different court dates in two different rooms, and that doesn't make any sense.
So get everything consolidated.
Correct. One housing court, and we have one or two judges that preside over all issues housing.
Okay. And Mark Moyo, briefly, about 25 seconds. What do you think?
I basically fully agree with what Matt just said. I would find that this court was working the way it was intended if it dissolved for lack of use in 5 years.
That's a powerful statement.
Lack of use.
Thank you. And I will say to Pam Owens-Dade, who made that first filing, I say this just in the spirit of kindness. Good luck to you. I don't know the people managing your property personally. I know the frustration that you feel. And so we'll be in touch. And thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
Ryan Acuff, member of the Citywide Tenant Union as well. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Matt Druin is a managing partner of Oak Grove Development. Thank you, man. Appreciate your perspective.
Hey, thank you.
And Mark Moyo, program director of the Housing Unit of the Legal Aid Society of Rochester. Not giving specific advice, but outlining the law.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks to Dolores Parlato, our wonderful volunteer on Fridays, some Fridays. Megan Mack is the producer. Emma Stein, the intern. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.